website at amomentofscience.org, where you can also view videos and sign up for podcasts. I'm Yael Cassander.
And I'm Don Glass.
In sports, Chris Allen has been indefinitely suspended from the Michigan State basketball team and will miss at least the team's Big Ten tournament opener. Coach Tom Izzo told reporters today the guard was suspended for not meeting responsibilities to his teammates. Allen usually starts and is the fifth leading scorer for the number 11 Spartans. Illinois junior Dimitri McCamey has been named to the Big Ten's first team in separate voting by conference coaches and members of the media. The coaches chose his teammate, DJ Richardson, as freshman of the year, while the media picked Northwestern's Drew Crawford. And the Chicago Bulls will try to avoid losing five in a row when they take on the Utah Jazz at the United Center tonight. Utah has won 8 of its last 10 road games to move into fourth place in the Western Conference. Chicago, meanwhile, has just a half-game lead over ninth-place Charlotte for the final playoff spot in the Eastern Conference. That's a look at sports.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
It's 2:42. This is the Afternoon Magazine from Illinois Public Media. Good afternoon. So glad you could be with us this afternoon. My name is Celeste Quinn, and my guest in this portion of the program is Patricia Falvey. Her debut novel is now in bookstores. The title, The Yellow House. It is a historical novel set in Ireland at the time of the Irish War of Independence, the war that led to the establishment of the Irish Free State. Patricia Falvey was born in Northern Ireland and raised in Ireland and England. She immigrated to the U.S. at the age of 20. Until recently, she was a managing director at PricewaterhouseCoopers. But a couple of years ago, at the top of her game as a tax expert, she decided to devote herself to writing, and the novel The Yellow Street is the result. The book is published by Center Street. Patricia, so glad you could talk with us this afternoon. How are you?
I'm delighted to be here, Celeste. Thank you. I'm well.
Would you tell us something about your family?
Yes, I was raised by my grandmother in the north of Ireland, as you mentioned, until I was about 8 years old, and I have a sister, and she and I were raised with my grandmother, but then I was brought with my parents to England, and my sister and my grandmother were left in the north of Ireland. I grew up the rest of my years with my parents in England until I was 20 years old, and I struck out on my own and came to the United States. So that's kind of where it stands. The rest is history.
I would imagine, now that I've heard a little of your story, that you identify in some ways with the protagonist of The Yellow House.
That is correct.
Eileen O'Neill.
Yes, you have it. Eileen, in the story, Eileen is in effect torn away from her home that she's known as when she's quite young. And our family is torn apart, and she spends the rest of the story trying to find a way to put back together the home that she had. And I think in many ways this book is my way of trying to mend that tear that happened long time ago and to kind of reconnect with home.
Yeah. Maybe this is quite personal, but what happened in your own family that caused that tear?
I really, to this day, don't totally know. I wish my mother, God bless her soul, has died, as has my grandmother. And I would love now, at this point in my life, to be able to really sit down with my mother and say, what happened and why did you do it the way you did it and why did you take just me and leave my sister and all the rest of it. But, you know, there are some things that are just unknown. And I was obviously very young. I was always mm-hmm. under the impression I was going back home. And, in fact, I used to every day when I first went to England, I would go outside the house and stand there and look up at an airplane that would go over at the same time every day. And I thought, that's the plane I'm going to get on and go back to Ireland. And little did I know, my sister told me just recently that right after it happened, she too would go outside, climb the wall in the back of our house, and watch the train coming in from Belfast to see was I on the train. So it was pretty traumatic for both of us, I think.
Yeah. Well, back to the story that you tell in The Yellow House. How did the conflicts of the period that you've set this story in, the Easter Uprising, the First World War, the Irish War of Independence, how do they affect Eileen O'Neill and her family?
Well, obviously it was a very turbulent period. When Eileen was born, which would have been 1895, there was already a movement underway in Ireland for home rule so that they could get independence from Britain and have their own, well, from England specifically, and have their own government. And so things were pushing along until the World War I came along. And at that point, home rule was put on the shelf, never really to be resurrected again. And so they were thrown into the people that were living both in the North and the South at the time were thrown into a period of limbo. And then when they saw that home rule was really not going very far, that is, of course, when the uprising started in 1916. And then that, particularly in the North, but all over Ireland, that started the sectarian violence flared up. And in the north of Ireland, there were the Catholic population was the minority in the north and in the province of Ulster. And so it just things got nastier, if you will, with the protests. And the Protestants in the north were very concerned that they would become part of a Catholic Southern Ireland. And so there was sectarian violence, there was burning of houses, there were riots, all of which impacted Eileen and her family and would have impacted my grandmother. And then, of course, young people were trying to make a decision whether or not they were going to get caught up in this battle, and Eileen particularly has to make a decision. She, in fact, ends up marrying a young man who is a passionate political activist and nationalist. And my grandfather, so I'm told, played such a role also, and he mysteriously disappeared, so no one ever really knew what happened to him, but he was one of the ones who continued fighting long after the border was drawn. And so things really came to a head when, in fact, a treaty was signed by Michael Collins. And if you who have seen the movie would remember this, that the treaty said, well, okay, the Southern Ireland, the great majority of the island can have its independence, but the North will stay with Britain. So then there was a civil war after that, and then ultimately the border was drawn. So it was a very unsettling and uncertain time for people living there, and particularly for Catholics living there, not knowing what their fate would be. And it was also obviously a very disruptive time. Mm. And so they had a lot that they had to deal with in terms of basically, and Eileen was not well off. She was a factory worker. She worked in a linen mill. And, you know, poverty was always kind of at the door. And so between that and trying to see what their fate would be ultimately was, I think, a real challenge for the people at that time. It had to be very, very difficult.
How did your grandmother talk about those events?
She talked a great deal about my grandfather, and she used to tell stories about how he would appear at the back door in the middle of the night, and this actually happens in the book, too. in the middle of the night in his bare feet, and his feet would be filled with thorns because he'd been running across the fields and the troops had been chasing him and all of this, and that he was gone a great deal of the time. And my mother was her first daughter, and she basically was left to raise her by herself a good part of the time because my grandfather was so taken up with the cause. So she had that same kind of ambivalence that she knew he had to fight for the cause of freedom, but by the same token, she was paying a lot of the cost of that.
Yeah. Now, at this time, there were a great number of Irish people coming to the U.S. Did your grandmother consider that?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that was ever in the cards for her. I mean, she got married fairly young, and I think her life was there with her husband who was caught up in the violence, and I don't think that would ever have been something that she would have done.
And is your family Catholic?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tough times.
Yes, and particularly in that area right on the border where they're sort of straddling the north and the south, and that was another part of the uncertainty because no one really knew where the line of the border would be drawn. And it could go around a house or around a farm or up a road or down a road. And, you know, it was just fate whether or not you were going to end up in southern the Republic of Ireland or whether you're going to end up in Great Britain.
As a child of eight, did you have some appreciation, some understanding of the difficulties?
Oh, yes, and also of the continuing sectarian divide that was very prevalent in Northern Ireland at the time. I mean, we lived in a small town, and yet, even as a child, I knew who the Protestant kids were and who the Catholic kids were, and I knew which stores were owned by Protestants and which stores were owned by Catholics, and you never crossed the line. And at one end of the street was the Catholic church. At the other end of the street would be the Protestant church. And everybody knew where they belonged. And I remember, of course, the Orange Order parades that used to take place quite often in July. Every July, and they still do to this day. And those are, you know, there's been some controversy over them because they do kind of stir things up somewhat when they do. They have what they call the marching season, and I was very aware of that. Was never allowed to go out of the house while that was going on.
Hmm. Where did you go to school then, as a young girl?
I went to a Catholic convent school when I was quite young. In Ireland, so with all of the nuns, the good sisters, and I also went to a Catholic convent school in England.
As a girl, I imagine that you were quite a reader because readers are the people who grow up to be writers.
Yes, yes.
What were your favorite books as a girl?
Oh, I loved books about school days. There was a set of books which was kind of interesting because it sort of almost could be a forerunner to Harry Potter, but it was called Jennings at School, and it was about a boy who went to boarding school, and there was a whole series of books about Jennings at School, and I remember we had a very small public library, and I, you know, was first in line to get all of those books. So, yeah, I loved reading, and, you know, we had a sort of a classical education when I was young growing up, so we had a lot of English writers and playwrights. We read all of Shakespeare's plays and so forth, but I always loved reading, and when I was very young, still even living in Northern Ireland, I still remember that I used to go to bed every night and tell myself stories in serial form, and I couldn't wait to go to bed to find out what was going to happen next in my own story.
So you were writing before you were writing, so to speak.
I was.
And when did you actually put pen to paper and put your stories down?
Well, when I first came to the States, I was 20 years old and, you know, full of possibilities and potential and adventure, but not very full of money. I only had about $200, as I recall it. So ultimately, I knew I wanted to go to school and get an education, but I was hoping that I could get a degree in English and get into the writing field, or if not that, then at least become a journalist. But I had very little money and very little direction and not a great deal of opportunity. I did get accepted at a school in Boston, Suffolk University, as a foreign scholar. And so they gave me some scholarship money. And my first professor was called Eugene O'Neill. And I was like, oh, this is going to be wonderful. It's a sign. But as time went on, it became pretty evident that jobs for English majors were not that plentiful. And it was actually much more of a business-oriented school. So I ended up becoming an accountant and a CPA and went on, got a master's in taxation, and ended up, once I had sort of started on that path, ended up going on that path and staying ultimately in public accounting and the financial services industry. But the writing never did leave me. I think with any of us who has something deep down that they know is kind of poking at them, that keeps saying, when are you going to do it? When are you going to do it? It never does leave you alone. And I went to a lot of writing conferences over those years. I read a lot of books about writing. I joined writing groups. I wanted to be around writers. I was always pulled towards them. And but I never really tried to take off and say, okay, I'm going to focus totally on doing this and trying to get published, until about 5 years ago when I, by pure chance, met a woman who turned out to be a literary agent in New York and who was just lovely. And we started talking about writing, and she said, what kind of stories do you want to write? And for some reason, this particular story, which I didn't even realize had been rattling around in my head, just started to come out. And she was very interested, asked me for the first 50 pages to get those to her in about 3 months. And I said to myself, oops, now what have I done? And so, but I got her the 50 pages, and she came right back and said, where is the rest of it? And so she was the one who really guided me and gave me the enthusiasm. It was one of those opportunity meets preparation times, because I had been studying the craft of writing for a long time. As I said, I was always a reader. But I'd never really taken that leap. And so about 6 months before the book was finally ready to go out to try to get it published, I finally quit all my ties with PricewaterhouseCoopers and said, you know, the stars are aligned. This will not happen again. You'd better do it now.
It sounds like it felt good, and it feels good today.
It feels, you know, I feel very whole. I feel complete. I think when there's something in your life that needs doing that you don't pay attention to, I think it always nags at you. And there were two things with me. One was writing, and the second was reclaiming my home back in Ireland. And I think through this book, I've managed to do both. And my sister and I are very, very close. And I get to spend a lot of time there, and a lot more time there now, because I have to go there to do research. So it's really all kind of come together at this point. It's been a long, circuitous journey, but it has come together.
Patricia, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
And to you, too. Thank you so much.
Patricia Falvey has been my guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. Her novel, The Yellow House, is published by Center Street, and I suspect it won't be long before there's another novel out from Patricia Falvey.
Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia de Camera, presenting Rhapsody for Two on Saturday, March 13th at 7:30 p.m. at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The program features works by Debussy,